Hey founders, this is the SaaS Boss Show, the podcast for SaaS founders in the growth stage who want to get unstuck, build high-performing teams, and get clarity about how to build a profitable startup. Every week, I interview SaaS consultants, coaches, and experts who work with dozens of startups just like yours and share their best strategies to overcome the daily challenges of growing a profitable SaaS. My name is Natalie Luniva, and I'm a growth and leadership coach to SaaS founders, and I'm also married to a SaaS founder, and I'm so pleased that you've joined us on this conversation. Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time to share this your experience. We've been getting lots of questions, so I'm really excited to talk to you about this. What's interesting is that pricing, it touches on so many areas of SaaS product, right? It's not just how much you charge for your product. It also identified perceived value or lack of value in your product. I interviewed Thomas Smale a while ago, the founder of FA International, and he said that the easiest way to increase your revenue is actually increase your pricing. And he says that that's what majority of companies that are buying other companies doing. So pricing is like definitely a big part of revenue or SaaS. But also there is an issue of at what point can we say that, you know, we started losing maybe some clients to pricing. So there are too many questions, not enough time. I don't want to lose a minute. Can you share with us high level overview? What it is that we're going to talking about today?
Yeah, totally. We're going to walk through a little bit of a framework of how to think about pricing, which I think is one of the most important things to do. Because I think a lot of people, they think, oh, it's just the number on the page. It's just how much you're actually charging. And in reality, there's a lot of different levers that you can pull with your pricing. So we're going to walk through those. And then normally in the Q&A, there just gets to be plenty of questions around how to do some of the details or how to adjust things or how to react to things in the market. I'm sure we'll get to those as well.
Awesome. Let's get the ball rolling.
Cool. Do you want me to share my screen and rock
yes.
out?
Like,
all
ahead.
Right. Cool. So let me just grab the screen. Can you see my screen? All right. One thing went well today. Love it.
Oh, guys, so, if you have any questions, drop them in a comment to this video.
So what we're going to be doing is I want to give you a framework for how to understand and ultimately optimize your monetization. And what I mean by that is, again, like how can I basically help you look at this as a growth lever within your business rather than just something you do, you know, once every, you know, couple of years or something like that. And so who am I to talk about this? So my background's in econometrics and math. I started my career working in US intelligence and then at Google. And then I started a company called ProfitWell about 8 years ago. We have a bunch of different tools. I'm not going to go into any of them. Except for we are sitting on a ton of data. We have about 20,000 companies using our free subscription financial metrics product. So it plugs into Stripe, Zora, Braintree, Recurly, whatever you're using, and gives you all of the reporting you need. And then we make money through a bunch of other fun products, one of which is particularly focused on pricing. So the big TLDR here, again, is not to sell you. That was a terrible sales pitch. But to kind of show you that since we have so many companies using the product, we're sitting on so much data, we can understand, you know, what works and what doesn't in the world of SaaS. And then, you know, expand it into the world of subscriptions as well. So when we set the stage here of what we're actually trying to do with monetization, I want you to think about either your business or the business that you're looking to start and just kind of realize that no matter what you're doing, and doesn't matter if you're a SaaS product, retail, nonprofit, whatever it is, you've created some sort of value. And because we don't trade, you know, goats for wheat anymore, what basically happens is you're ascribing that value to a dollar amount or whatever your currency in particular is. And so the way I want you to think about your pricing and your monetization in general is that your pricing is the exchange rate on the value that you're creating. So if we go one step deeper, then we start to realize that everything that we're doing from our sales and our marketing all the way to our finance team and our operations and our product teams is used to drive someone to a point of conversion or to justify the product or the price that they're offering. And so when we start to realize this, there's a bunch of different levers, right? There's the actual people we sell to. You might be selling to someone who doesn't have any money for what you're offering, or maybe they don't value the thing that you're offering. This is why a lot of companies will go up market or down market, because they're trying to find that market that, you know, really fits towards their product. You can obviously adjust the product, not only in terms of features that you can ship, but there's also things where you can pull features out and make them add-ons or, you know, differentiate them in a more proper manner. And then ultimately there is the price, which is not only something that will impact conversion, but it also impacts the perception of your particular product. Because if you're a more premium product, you should be priced premium. There's nothing worse, and this happens all the time in the world of SaaS, where your price is basically so cheap, people are starting to question the quality of it. And so what's the number that we look at if we go even one layer deeper? Well, to know if you're really taking advantage of monetization, you want to look at your ARPU, your average revenue per user. Now, you might measure this in a couple of different ways, ACV or ARPA, but once you start measuring it and looking at this framework, you start to realize, hey, there's a bunch of easy things that we can do. We can adjust how much of our product we give away for a particular price point. We obviously, as Thomas said, can increase our prices. There's an add-on strategy, which is one of the most underutilized pieces of the world of pricing and SaaS out there. And then, of course, there's a bunch of harder things. And these are not mutually, or these are not exhaustive, but, you know, going up market is actually harder today than it was, you know, 10 years ago. And so is, you know, feature differentiation, just because there's so many features out there. And so ARPU is the really, really big thing. And for the sake of time, the one data point I want to show you here is that it takes a lot of time, not because it's actually hard, but because people kind of get in their own way to actually adjust their pricing. It's actually about 3 years. Now, what's interesting is that younger companies tend to update their pricing more quickly because they're not as old school in terms of not knowing that this is a growth lever. But what we've consistently found is that those folks who make more pricing changes, and this does not mean just raising their price. This means adding different add-ons, adjusting their discounts, changing up their customer profiles, these types of things, they tend to have those higher ARPU. So this line here, these are companies that change their price every quarter. This line down here are those who change it every 3 years. And so again, if you measure something and you focus on it, you tend to improve it or change it. Now, why is this so important right now? I'm going to scare you a little bit, and I'm going to scare you also by going quickly to make sure that we don't go too far over time. We've lost a lot of our power as businesses. I don't know how old the people on the call are, but if you've been in the business for 20, 30 years, yes, SaaS existed in the 90s, if anyone never told you. It was one of those things where over the past 20-ish years, we were basically getting the ability to ship product quicker. And to the point that all of us, if we want to start a brand new company by the end of the day, we could spin up a server, spin up a website, and everything would be great. The other thing that was amazing is we were getting all these brand new marketing channels really, really quickly. So we had Google AdWords for a penny a click. Then we had remarketing, Google Display Network, Yahoo Display Network, all of these different pieces. So if you're building a company from 2000 to 2012, 2015 or so, things were amazing. But now, unfortunately, what's happened is we haven't had a new marketing channel since 2015. And we're all reaching a point where we're shipping, not necessarily as fast as one another, but we're shipping relatively close together. So there's so many competitors out there, even if they're not direct competitors. So your customer acquisition costs are up about 70% over the past 6-7 years. I'll share this data afterward. Your product value, just the perceived value of your product according to customers, is down by about 60 to 80% over the past 5-6 years. And customers are more unhappy than ever. It's not because they're unhappy, but it's just because software isn't as magical as it once was. And these are NPS scores over kind of a 6-year period. And so the big thing I kind of want to leave you with is when you really think about what's happened in the market, you used to be able to just spend money like it's 2005. You used to be able to just spend money. You just used to be able to acquire customers. But what's happened in the past couple of years is that basically now you need to be good at acquisition just to survive. And where a lot of the growth is coming from, and we see this consistently in the data, are from those companies who have more of a balanced growth approach, which means they're still spending half their budget on sales, marketing, et cetera. But in addition to that, they're spending more than, you know, the 30 hours a year on pricing and things like retention. And so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit again for the sake of time. Here's some fun data. And we're going to talk about what we can actually do. So I'm going to talk about this because I don't know all the stages of everyone on the call. I'm going to talk about this in a very phased approach. And we're going to start with like getting your stuff together. So these are the two foundational things if you're a SaaS company that I believe that you need to focus on. And if you are an advanced company and you haven't done these things, you need to do them very, very quickly. If you're just really early stage, these are the two things to worry about when you're getting your pricing strategy, you know, moving forward initially. Because of course, this is never going to be your only and number one priority. It's one of those things where we want to figure out what are the things that we can get right that allow us to, you know, get as much leverage as possible. So the first one is, and this is the thing that if you get everything else wrong, but you get this right or even somewhat right, you'll be okay. And what that is charging based off of a value metric. Now, a value metric, it's what you charge for. For someone like Intercom, it's based off the number of people that flow through the messaging product. One of their competitors, Drift, very, very similar company, but they charge based on seats. Wanted to show an example where you could see two very competitive companies doing very different value metrics. And the reason for this is because Drift predominantly targets sales folks, whereas Intercom predominantly targets, you know, sales, products, support, and a bunch of other different types of personas. Now, the reason that this is so important is that if you remember back to your economics class, either in high school or in college, you probably realized or were told that essentially there's all these little points on a demand curve that you can go after, and that would be your particular price point. Well, with a value metric, you get price points for every type of buyer because they're entering based on their actual usage. So if it's a company that only needs two seats, you can sell to them. If it's a company that needs 1,000 seats, you can sell to them, and you make sure you're not charging them the same amount of money. Just to show you kind of how this works out in terms of numbers. So this is growth based on the pricing model. So the light green are those folks who are pure value metric companies. And these are folks who, you know, don't have feature differentiation. And then the dark green are those folks who have feature differentiation as their primary pricing. And the reason this growth actually exists is because churn is really, really good. If I'm not using as much of the product, I end up paying less, and presumably I might downgrade, but it's one of those things where I'm not necessarily going to churn. And if I've connected this with a freemium offer, all of a sudden I have this huge spectrum of users that can essentially come in and use the product how they'd like. Here's some data basically just showing that churn is much, much lower for those folks who use value metrics versus those who don't. And of course, the other side of the equation here is expansion revenue is really, really high. Your users are going to use your product at different levels. You want to make sure that those folks who are using more of your product are getting more value. It doesn't necessarily have to be a perfect measure of usage, are essentially the ones who are, you know, paying for it. And you can see here that essentially, the value metric folks, as they use more, as they get more of the value metric, they tend to expand their revenue. And it's also a really good relationship with your customers because you're essentially saying you're only going to pay for the value you get, assuming that they buy into the value. So I already said this, but if you get everything else wrong, but your value metric right, you're going to be okay. And the way to get this right, we don't have time to get deep, deep, deep into it. I'll send some articles over that you can find, but the basic like mental model is think of what is the perfect value for your product, even if you can't measure it. So maybe it's the amount of time, the amount of joy you bring them. I know that sounds fluffy, but like think of the actual pure value metric for them. It might be the, you know, in B2B, it's typically cost you save them, revenue you bring them, efficiency you bring them. And if you can measure it, and your customer agrees with your measurement of the value metric, then that should be your value metric. Now, if you can't measure it, and sometimes it's hard, you know, HubSpot at the end of the day, it's the amount of revenue they bring you through marketing activities. But oftentimes what ends up happening is you can't measure that revenue perfectly. So then what you need to do is you need to take a step back and find a proxy. So for HubSpot, it's things like contacts, number of visits, not even users, it's basically those contacts. But that's kind of how you find it. It's find the ideal one, and then if you can measure it, great. If not, take one step back. And then you should test this amongst your users by doing some research, which the materials I'll send over will get deep into that. The next big piece for your early days, and this is the one that you have heard for a long time if you've ever been in the game or have ever sought out how to start a business advice, but you probably have done only 5% of the actual work to make sure you're determining your market. And the reason is that if we go back to our mental model here, our framework, and we think about, hey, we're driving people to these point of conversions, or we're justifying the product or the price for that persona. If you do not know who these people are, or at least the segments that you should be targeting, it is nearly impossible to set up proper pricing, let alone a good funnel or a flywheel, depending on who you ask these days, let alone the product, et cetera. And so the really, really big thing is not just to have like little personas that, you know, Grandpa HubSpot and Grandma Marketo have been talking about for a decade or so, but to really, really focus on quantifying these folks. And so here's just kind of an example. We have a spreadsheet internally. Over the top of the spreadsheet in the columns, there are different personas that we target. There's more than two of them. And the rows in the spreadsheet, we have different categories of what are the most valued features, least valued features, NPS scores, lifetime value, a whole host of things. And you should be collecting data on this information, but even if you don't collect data to validate or invalidate these pieces, just having this in a more detailed form helps you have your arguments internally in a much, much better fashion. So if our CPO comes to me and says, hey, I want to work on, you know, something like, you know, the design, you know, of the site. What I'll say is, listen, I understand design is important, obviously, but right now the higher value things that we need to go after, since we're targeting Meredith here, are things like accuracy and uptime and reliability. And in the nature of building a company, you are resource constrained, and that's an understatement. So you want to make sure that you're focused on who you're going after. Now, ultimately, you want to validate these folks, and that uses kind of a bastardized version of the scientific method here. So you want to make sure you're collecting a bunch of fun data, running it through some statistical models. You can make this much more complicated if you want, and then ultimately going and checking those buyer personas or those ideal customer profiles, however you want to define them, and then you earn your paycheck and really understand your pricing strategy. And the reason this is also super important is that when we were building ProfitWell, which was our second product, we started off actually with the pricing product. We realized after doing this research that this is what our unit economics looks like for two of the personas that we were going to go after. And I'm sure a lot of you have caught up ahead, where basically Startup Steve, we were making no money, and Mid-Enterprise Meredith, we were going to be underwater. And so for a bootstrap company that doesn't have a lot of money to just kind of throw stuff up against the wall, this was really, really important to realize, because we didn't waste 18 months trying to figure out, oh, wait, these customers just aren't great. We knew this really early on in our dev cycle, and we were able to act. And this is what led, and I can talk about this more in the Q&A, this is what led to basically using the freemium model for our metrics product. And we were, between that killing the product or going up market, and going up market in the analytics space costs a lot of money. So it led to basically the freemium product, which also is not cheap, but there's a much, you know, wider strategy here to keep in mind. I guarantee you there is a segment on some vision document you have, journals, text messages to your co-founders, your execs, whomever it is, that is terrible for your business. And what I mean by this is, we as founders and execs, we're always looking at what could be. And so we kind of rationalize based on anecdotal information, qualitative data, even quantitative data, where we should take our company. But if we don't really go deep into the weeds and understanding those segments, oftentimes we allow that vision to kind of take over who we should be targeting. And you get examples of, you know, I have, you know, a lot of companies we've worked with, and this is a not so positive example, so I need to not, you know, tell you who it is. But, you know, a company that raised $130 million, they spent $30 million acquiring a certain type of customer that was only paying them $30 a month, was costing them in hosting costs $1,200 a month. That was the first mistake. And the customer was making about $1 million a year on their platform. They didn't realize this until they burned through $30 million in acquisition, and then they had to raise the price by, you know, 10 to 20X on these folks. And a lot of them stayed, but it was one of those things that they could have realized this a lot earlier on and not been so inefficient and not wasted so much cash. So make sure you understand your market. You want to say, hey, Steve Jobs didn't talk to his customers, blah, 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 blah. Well, Steve Jobs did not compete in 2015. And also Apple spends, you know, top five in market research every single year. They do a ton of market research, and you're never going to necessarily always listen to your customers, but you should be talking with them. Cool. Do you want me to pause there and do questions, or you want me to keep going?
Let's see. We don't have any questions just yet. Cool. So let's just keep going.
All right. Well, let's grow up then. So when you've kind of figured out these two pieces, and I'm more than happy to get deep into, you know, doing research, asking people about willingness to pay and stuff like that. So if you have that question, make sure to hit it up. But here's some other bigger topics that you have to think about. First one is price localization. If you're a more established company and you're scared to go do a bigger project, like your value metrics or your personas, this is a really good starting point. If you're, you know, a smaller company, this is not a great starting point. Although it would be beneficial, you just don't have necessarily a huge customer base yet. So the gains you'll make through price localization aren't really there. But price localization is basically making sure that you are pricing based on the currency of the customer you're going after, as well as the demand of the customer you're going after. And the reason that this is so powerful is because even if you just cosmetically update your prices, so this is the cosmetic localization, this is the control, no localization, you're going to see a lift in your overall average revenue per user because you're going to get more people to purchase. It's just something innate. We want to trust the currency we normally pay in. Sometimes banks, you know, will have restrictions if we're not paying in the currency that we're going to pay in. It's something that cosmetically it works really well. Now, more advanced, you're actually going to update your pricing based on the density of the region. And you're going to make sure the price is effectively different in the United States versus the UK versus Western Europe, maybe versus Eastern Europe, and so on and so forth. And the reason for this, just to show you just differences in willingness to pay, this is all willingness to pay relative to the United States. We're based in the United States, so sorry, that's a little ethnocentric, I'm sure. But it's one of those things where, you know, the UK relative to the US, and this is 1.5 million different data points on willingness to pay. So there's a lot of different products in here. Your product probably is going to have different variants than what you're seeing. But in the UK, you know, about 15-20% higher, Western Europe 20% higher, Nordics are always willing to pay the most. I think it's just because of the standard and cost of living there. And then down here, obviously Southeast Asia and Brazil, typically less than what's happening in the US. So localize your pricing. The reason I think this is a really good starter project is because if you think about what you'd have to do to localize, you have to get your billing system in order, these types of things. It's also a pretty easy thing to do when you're looking at like politics internally. And even if you're a 5-person company, you're going to have politics around pricing. But just something that happens because everyone's kind of sensitive to it. And that's what brings me to the next point, a committee. And I understand that this is probably the most boring point that I could make, but it's actually probably the highest impact thing that you can do inside your company, no matter the size. And this really comes down to making sure that you have a pricing process. And what I mean by that is making sure that even if it's just you and a co-founder, you have a date on the calendar, a recurring meeting that's maybe once a month, once a quarter, once every 6 months, just to revisit the pricing. The reason for this is because what ends up happening with topics like pricing and sizing is that there's no one team that necessarily owns this or owns it in its entirety. The design of the product, the design team. Now, other people might have an opinion on it, but they're going to ultimately own it, right? Whereas with pricing, it touches multiple teams, marketing, product, sales, finance, a bunch of other teams, depending on the size of your company as well. And so what we really, really recommend doing is make sure you have the right people in the room and make sure they're meeting somewhat regularly. You should be changing something about your pricing every quarter. This is not saying increase your price every quarter. What I'm saying is you should be making an adjustment very similar to you make adjustments in your sales, your marketing process. You should be making adjustments to your monetization process as well. Because if your product and your brand, all these things are improving, your pricing should improve as well. Now, the cycle we recommend, it's just a quarterly research cycle. Depending on your size, maybe you meet at the beginning of the quarter, and then all of a sudden you decide, hey, is there something we're going to work on, something we're going to research? Someone goes off and basically does the research. Normally in a larger organization, this is like a marketing manager or product manager, and it's only 20% of his or her time typically. This is not a full-time gig unless you're, you know, $100 million plus company. And then all of a sudden that person comes back, they talk with the committee, whoever's on it, make a decision, and then based on the gravity of the decision, you might go through some of these pieces and then you implement them and track. Now, who's in the room? Kind of already measured this. Sales is one of those folks. They're always, always going to derail pricing if you do not involve them in the early process. It's just something where they're sensitive to how pricing changes. And so you want to get their opinions, but you also want their input. Marketing, product, and corp dev or finance. Now, traditionally, who should be in charge and who should be the main decision maker? Typically, the leader of marketing or the leader of product. Sales, the incentives just aren't necessarily aligned, and finance is really good at Excel engineering pricing, but the inputs might not be great. There's always exceptions to that statement, but it's one of those things to kind of think about. But the big things here, deadlines and decision makers. You're going to be skittish about pricing. You're going to be skittish about raising prices, changing prices. You're just going to be nervous about it. And the big reason is because ultimately this is something that touches so many different things and also obviously affects your customers. So make sure you have deadlines, make sure you have decision makers. Cool. Couple more points here. I can just keep going, Natalie. I'm going to wait until you interrupt me, okay?
Sounds good. Go ahead.
All right, cool. So establishing a customer research cycle. I already kind of really talked about this point, but to give you some data, and I already made my Steve Jobs terrible joke, But the thing is, and I talked about this a little bit in the beginning, a lot of us are building the wrong product. So I'm going to display this. I'm going to double dip here, not only give you data that supports this point, but also give you another really good framework for understanding value and pricing of your product. So it's a nice little classic 2x2, and we'll talk about a cup of coffee here. So if I'm trying to determine the monetization path for a cup of coffee, there's typically two axes of you know, willingness to pay or value. The first axis is the features. So what is the relative value of these different features? Do the customers I'm targeting care about taste? Do they care about country of origin? Do they care about temperature? What does that actually look like? And then the other axis is, what does willingness to pay look like? And so what I can do is, using some methodologies that are open source, you can make them more complicated. Our software, we made these much more complicated, but you don't need to use our software, is I can ask a segment. I can ask whoever's listening to this. I can ask a segment of Salt Lake City where I am, a segment of Boston where our headquarters is, or even a segment of Rosario where our other office is. And I can find out that overall, compared to all the other features, the most important feature is relative to the others. People are pretty indifferent about temperature, and the least favored relative to the other features is country of origin. It doesn't mean that country of origin isn't a very preferred feature for someone. It just means, in the aggregate, compared to these other features, this one is the least valuable. Now, using another methodology that's, you can use open source, you can make it more complicated, there's software you can buy as well, I can find out that those people whose number one feature, they're willing to pay about 25% more. Those people whose number one feature is temperature, they're willing to pay about 20% less. And those people who, country of origin, the hipsters in the audience here, who really care about where their coffee comes from, they're willing to pay about 35% more. So the framework is, if I find a feature, a value proposition, an aspect of the product that in aggregate for that segment is highly valued, and the people who care about it as their number one are willing to pay more for it, that's a differentiable feature. Low value relative to everyone else, but the people who really care about it are willing to pay more, that's an add-on. High value relative to everyone else, and the people who really care about it aren't willing to pay more, this is typically a core feature. And then, we don't talk about this with our customers, but in marketing we'll say, it's trash, right? Now you're gonna have to build some trash, don't get me wrong. Like mobile apps in certain spaces, like fleet management and things like that, it shows up in trash. The login screen would show up in trash. These are just things that are just like so table stakes, and you're not going to get any credit for building them. So we went out to about 1,300 product leaders, and we asked them, for your last N features, where would you put them in these four boxes? And this is what they said for just under 5,000 features. So there's a lot of confidence. Obviously, they're building these features, so there is a lot of confidence. There's some insecurity down here, of course, as well. But we then went out and asked about 1.2 million different customers of these products in a composite study, using the methodologies we've developed, and again, they're kind of cousins of the open source ones that you can use. And this is what the customer said. So this is what we think we're building, and this is what we're actually building.
I love it. I love it. The framework that you shared before is, I think it just need to give it a second to sink in for everyone to take a screenshot and think about it when they're building those features. And then those additional two screenshots are like really eye-openers, right?
Yeah, totally. And the thing to think about to connect the dots here is, this wasn't always this way. Because when there weren't as many features, there wasn't as much product, there weren't as many expectations, you know, features moved very, very slowly through these quadrants. Because features move. Not all of the features will move. Your core, super core feature probably won't move. But it took about 8 to 10 years, or at least that was the velocity, for features to move from one quadrant to another. We took a snapshot about 2.5 years ago now. And this is what it looks like now in terms of where features move, because they're moving much more quickly. So some features will obviously move quicker than others, but now the velocity is basically a fifth of what it once was. And so it's huge. It's huge, huge, huge. Another big thing, and this is another very, very practical thing for you, is how to raise prices. And yes, you should raise prices. 80 to 85% of the people that we talk to are typically underpriced. The problem becomes figuring out how much you're underpriced, but you're probably underpriced, and you might think, oh, that's okay, I'll just get more volume. Software doesn't work like that. Well, not all software works like that. There is a point where your price is too cheap that people are going to start questioning the quality of your product. And so a couple things to actually go after and change in terms of pricing. So first up, I'm not a really big fan of keeping people on legacy plans. I think that you should raise prices on existing customers. Now, there are some exceptions here. Obviously, your earliest and early customers, maybe you want to kind of reward them for being so beta customers with you. Also, if you have an incredibly large total addressable market, you can get away with not raising prices on existing customers, but I think it's, you know, you're basically not using a growth lever. The other thing is physically raising prices, you probably can only do once per year. It's really hard to do it more than once per year on the same customer unless you're flying. HubSpot, prior to the IPO, they were raising prices once every 6 months. And that's because they were shipping so much and moving so quickly. Now, in terms of like actually moving forward, make sure you do your research. And this goes into like how much you should actually raise your prices. I'll share some resources on how you can actually do this after the call. You're going to probably want to run an impact analysis. And anyone who is basically getting a larger than a 50% increase in their price, you probably want to personalize or even give them a phone call depending on the actual magnitude of the price. They're going from $1 to $2. Don't worry about it too much. If you're going from, you know, $500 to $1,000, it's probably worth a phone call for that individual to explain what's going on and soften the impact a little bit. Now, in terms of messaging, here's some really practical messaging. Use this as a template, but obviously adjust it for your own means. The first thing that we want to do is we want to remind them of the value. We want to pull in some actually good data that they are using. Like, hey, they're using feature B. You're using it daily. We've made you this much money. Your contacts have grown this much over the past 12 months. Actually quantify as much as humanly possible how much value you're bringing them. Then you want to remind them, or basically introduce the price increase, but you want to remind them that it's to invest in making the product better for them. Then you want to make sure that you reward them for being loyal. So because they've been with you for 4.5 years or whatever it is, we're going to give what's called a legacy discount, which means, hey, for everyone else, all these new people who weren't as loyal as you, they're going to get the new price that's increased. For you, though, you're getting your existing price for the next 6 months. And after that, we're going to bump you up to the new price. I mean, obviously, you want to give them an out. Thanks for being a part of, or thank you for letting us be a part of your growth. If you have any questions at all, let us know. Now, the really, really nice thing to do here is also throw in this PS. If this materially impacts your business or your life, if you're a D2C product, let me know and we'll work something out. This PS serves two purposes. One, if someone actually is being impacted in their business, especially this year with all the crazy stuff going on, you probably want to be nice and get a lot of brand value and basically say, not a problem at all. We'll meet in the middle discount, or we'll just let you on your legacy plan for a longer period of time. This PS is also for folks like me. And what I mean by that is, I don't want to spend any more money. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to spend more money for the thing that I'm getting. You know, I have to worry about a P&L, right? But after you've reminded me of how much value I'm getting and all of these different things, now with this PS, I look at this and go, oh no, I like the product. I'm not going to fuss about it. Like all that kind of stuff. And I don't respond, or I just kind of accept the price increase. A lot of things you can do. This legacy discount as well as this PS work really, really well. Couple of rapid fires, and I have data to support all of these, and I'm happy to share it with you if you really want the specific data or at least the output of the data. Design, support, and brand, they now all correlate with higher willingness to pay. This wasn't always the case, especially in SaaS and B2B software. Design wasn't necessary. Brand wasn't that big of a deal. Now, all of a sudden, if you have good design, good support, good brand, all of those things pay, and also increase retention. Value propositions, they greatly differentiate willingness to pay, meaning just your messaging, it can change willingness to pay dramatically. What we've seen in both B2B and in the consumer space is just changing literally the H1 on your website can change willingness to pay by about 15-20%, both in a positive and in a negative direction. Customer success, it doesn't actually help with churn. We've seen this in the data. It helps with expansion revenue. And so really kind of change your mind a little bit about this, I would say. There's a lot to talk about with that bullet, though, so obviously don't, you know, take too much of a generalization. But the big thing to kind of see is that customer success has the biggest impact on expansion revenue versus churn. Cool. I did a 45-minute presentation in like 25 minutes, so hopefully I didn't bother everyone. But if you ever want to get a hold of me, I'm just patrick@profitwell.com. We do free pricing audits. Basically, if you're hooked up to Profitwell, we can give you some really, really cool benchmarks and things like that. But also know that, you know, we're not going to try to sell you if you don't want to be sold. We're really big into evangelism and just educating the market. So don't be afraid to hit me up. If you have a question on pricing, retention, or just subscription benchmarks, who probably published a post on it. And if not, I probably know where to find it. So don't worry about Googling. You can just email me and I can hook you up. But Natalie, any questions?
Absolutely. We have a ton of questions. The question to you is, do we have only 5 minutes left or can you do like a little bit more?
I can go over just for you though. And just because I was terrible, Jen ended up breaking my camera before this call.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. So a question from Thomas Kong. He is asking, what is the most effective versus most popular pricing model for SaaS businesses? The most popular is obviously a subscription model. Would consumption-based tier model or one-time or lifetime model make sense?
So the term, is that what the question's about?
The most effective pricing model.
So pricing, so meaning, but then it sounds like they were asking about lifetime subscription. Is that kind of what they're getting at?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So I think that the only reason, because sometimes value metrics is what people refer to as pricing models. I just want to make sure I was answering the right question. So I think, so subscriptions have obviously kind of started to take over the world here. And the reason that I believe that it's one of the most effective pricing models is because it bakes the relationship with your customer into how you make money. So what I mean by that is it's the first commerce model where your customer and you, every single term, whether it's monthly, quarterly, annually, they're using the product. And if they keep getting value, they're going to keep that relationship. And if they don't see value, they're going to end the relationship, right? Whereas like, you know, a retail environment, I have to keep convincing you to come in. And yes, I may build a brand and build a relationship with you, but all of a sudden you might see a coupon in the paper that takes you to another store rather than coming back to me, depending on your habits and things like that. And so I think subscriptions make a ton of sense, but there's a lot of things you can do within subscriptions to account for your market as well as some of the not so great pieces about subscriptions. You can have a pay-per-use model in addition to a subscription. You can have a lifetime plan and you can peg that at the lifetime value of your current product because you cover your lifetime value. So there's a whole host of things that you can do, but it is one of those things that, you know, I think the subscription model or the recurring revenue model, it might not always be a perfect subscription, is typically where most folks should go because there's just so many advantages for both the customer as well as for the business.
Tell us a little bit more about your freemium. You mentioned that that's exactly what you went with for revenue, for profit. Well, Courtney is asking, how do you see freemium versus flat rate versus pay as you go? And if it's different, and if it's different for B2C versus B2B?
Yeah, great question. So freemium, the thing you got to keep in mind with freemium, it's an acquisition model. It's not a pricing model. So what I mean by that is you have to think about freemium like a premium ebook. And the reason for this is that your goal with freemium is to basically lower the barrier to entry for your prospect to come onto your product and then somehow either through giving them a limited amount of your product, it should be full featured, but a limited amount of a value metric, so that they use up that value metric within 14 days if they're your target customer and then convert hopefully to a paid plan. Or you're trying to attract a particular customer base that you're then going to sell them something else. And this is what we did with Profitwell. And so I think the thing with freemium, and I used to write very anti-freemium blog posts, you know, 6-7 years ago before I saw the light here. So I've been on both sides of this hotly religious debate that happens with freemium. The thing you have to think about is with the CAC implications of these different channels, the customer acquisition cost implications, it is going to start to become necessary to have some sort of product that brings a customer in rather than bringing in through, you know, an ebook or something like that. So I think it's one of those things to kind of think through. You have to commit to it. You can't be a crappy version of your product. It has to be good. People have to enjoy using it. And then ultimately you also have to make sure that when you're looking at what's going on with freemium, you're, you know, basically ensuring that you do have a path to monetization. So the best folks in the world at freemium, they typically don't start their freemium plan until 3-4 years into the business, unless they're a consumer, you know, SMB typically product where they are trying to attract, you know, they have someone who's really good at growth and then they're trying to get a network effect basically out of bringing people on board. So yeah, big fan of freemium. Retention typically is about 10 to 15% better for those customers who convert from freemium than those who convert from a free trial or even from a cold start. NPS is typically better for those customers who converted from freemium. And then customer acquisition cost is typically about 30% lower for those who converted from freemium. So hopefully those are some helpful facts to kind of think about freemium. We wrote a book on freemium. I think if you go to profitwell.com/freemium, I'm pretty sure it's /freemium, you'll find that book that you can check out.
Thank you. Joshua Taylor is saying huge value. Lots of people say that it's a lot of value. Thank you so much for that. But we still have a bunch more questions. You gave a really nice framework for how to increase the prices. But when does it make sense to lower the price? For example, for my husband and his SaaS, we've raised prices probably 3 times. People now are still not complaining. Majority of people are not complaining. But I think we're at the point where we're questioning, okay, some minority people are complaining about price, but what's the percentage of people that we don't even hear from that are not complaining about price, that are not signing up because the price is too high?
Yeah, so I think, so this is where research comes into play, because if you're in B2B or early on in any industry, you do not have enough traffic to do like true A/B or even multivariate testing, which is required for, you know, if you think about the classic pricing page, you got 3-4 tiers, you know, maybe 4 or 5 main features in those tiers. You're talking about, you know, depending on the choices you make, 80 some variations of those pages. So the thing to kind of keep in mind is do your research. So when I hear raise the prices 3 times, depending on if those were correlated with improvements in the product, you want to make sure that like you're measuring willingness to pay and then going, oh, okay, this is where our ceiling is right now. We can choose to go at that ceiling or a little bit lower depending on the other data that we're seeing. In terms of lowering prices, I'm actually a bigger fan, not of lowering prices, but introducing cheaper tiers or a lower value metric. Because if you think about a value metric, you're kind of just picking your entry point and then kind of the price per unit. You might not price it actually per unit, but you might actually, you know, bundle it. So, hey, 0 to 10 users is this price, 11 to whatever, or you might charge per user, right? So the thing is to kind of keep in mind is that I would rather introduce a cheaper version of the product that is more geared towards that lower end persona rather than like taking my current tier and lowering the price on it. Because your goal is ultimately to have people who either come in high, come in middle, or even come in low, but all of them are growing over time as they come into your product and use more of it. So yeah, I mean, I think to maybe more intellectually honestly answer your question, if you truly are in like a more commoditized market, the market got super commoditized, you know, with new entrants and a whole host of things, you may need to lower the price. But the thing is you have to make sure that you are doing some of that research so that you're not kind of willy-nilly raising and lowering the price.
Another question from Arup, a member of my mastermind group, is lower pricing a disadvantage if features are the same?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think all things being equal, maybe, but typically things aren't equal, so no. What I mean by that is anytime someone is buying you strictly for price, if you are not in a commoditized market, and we all think our markets are more commoditized than not, like Profitable Metrics has 45 different competitors. If you really look at direct and indirect competitors, and you know, we are the cheapest, but people don't use us because we're free. They use us because we're better. There's plenty of people who use some of our paid competitors. And then when they discover us, they come to us for a whole host of reasons. So I think the thing that you have to think about is, like, who are you going after and ultimately why are you bringing them in? And you don't want them thinking of you as the low price product unless you're a discount brand. So long story short, I think that all things being equal, sure, like if you're truly in a competitive commoditized market, if you're cheaper, great. Like obviously whoever sells the cheapest gold is going to sell it really quickly, right? But that's the commoditized market kind of sets the price. I think for most SaaS products, you really have to think about your brand and who your customer is, and then realize that your competitors maybe aren't targeting the same people. There are some folks that we were very, very much competitive with and we were going after the same crowd. And now we're not going after the same customers at all. And that impacts the business as well and kind of that strategy. So yeah, hopefully a little that was useful. A little rambly, unfortunately. Sorry about that.
Merul is asking, I finished your book, SaaS Pricing Anatomy, last week. What would be recommended next to learn more about pricing and master it? By the way, great book. How can people download it?
That one, if you just search, I use Google search all the time.
I know, me too. I can find it, but hey, how can you?
Yeah. Just search Price Intelligently Pricing Book. And you should find it. If you go to priceintelligently.com, we still have that domain.
Awesome.
I mean, just scroll down. It'll have the book. But yeah, or just email me and I can send it to you if that works too.
And then, so what's the next book that you would recommend?
There's a really good book. If you're really trying to go deep on pricing, if you're not trying to go deep on pricing, what we give you is a pretty good foundation. But if you want to go beyond that, there is a book called The Strategy and Tactics of Pricing, which is like an MBA, typically a signed book. It gets deep into the theory. It's a little bit less practical, but it'll be really, really useful in terms of the theory of it. And the other thing is just start, you know, reading on our blog. We also have a pricing page teardown video series where we go deep into the pricing pages and strategies of a bunch of different SaaS and D2C and media companies. And so just search for that. That'll give you a little more practical knowledge versus the strategy and tactics of pricing.
Aaron, a member of my mastermind group is asking, if your SaaS is like Twilio, it does not charge the same per month. Customers are paying you through four different ways: credit cards, Square, Stripe, PayPal. Would ProfitWell work as a way to chart growth versus and churn?
It really depends on how you set up your billing system. So I'd encourage you to email me or just literally just try to sign up with one of the billing systems. And the reason is because if you've set up some of those not properly. If you set those things up in a certain way, properly for ProfitWell, is what I meant to say, then they'll work really well. If you kind of are just doing all of the work on the client side, then all of a sudden they'll actually, you know, we'll just see cash flow data versus anything. But I will say that that type of model that was just described, I do think that that is the future. I think that there won't be like a very specific subscription. I think there's going to be like your subscription fluctuates every month based on like the amount you're using or the amount of value you're getting. And so, yeah, those are kind of ahead of the game. There's a lot of industries that are just not ready for that type of pricing, but that's kind of where the market's heading.
Got it. Lots of questions that were asked. I want to say one of the last questions, Patrick, is there a question that you see majority of people ask that we have not asked you just yet that you think is going to bring the most value to people?
Yeah, there's a difference between most asked and value there. So you threw me for a loop there. I get asked a lot about, should you end your prices in nines or zeros? And the answer is, should not be the primary focus. If you've done a bunch of different things and then this is something you want to test, great. But and the theory is ending in nines is more of a discount brand. Ending in zeros or fives is more of a luxury brand. And so depending on, you know, software, it doesn't always work as well, but you'll see like Tiffany's, you know, jewelry is always fives or zeros. Whereas a discount brand, it's always 7, 8, or 9. I think value metrics we talked about, okay, we talked about customer profiles, we talked about. No, I can't think of one question that kind of stands out. It's typically like, how do you ask these questions to your customers or your prospects? Or aren't they just going to lie to you? And the answer is, and we didn't get deep into it, but you have to ask the questions in the right way. So I would never ask someone just like straight up like, hey, what are you willing to pay for this? Like human beings, we just don't think about value that way. We think about it as a spectrum. So we know that, you know, this bottle of water is, you know, cheaper than this computer I'm on, although because the Zoom isn't working, maybe that's not the case anymore. But we just kind of know that. And so I want to ask it range questions. You know, at what point is this way too expensive that you never consider purchasing it? At what point is it a really good deal, right? And when I get kind of a confluence of those answers, that's when I can kind of map and realize, you know, where the willingness to pay really is for that segment. And there's more, we've written a ton on this and I can send it over, but I will say that the big thing to keep in mind is that you do have to talk to your customers. And if you ask them in the right manner, you're going to get a de-biased look. And you're not going to eliminate all bias because there's no data that doesn't have any bias. But you're going to be able to reduce the bias pretty significantly. And if you ask questions amongst your current customers, your prospects, and then this group called market panelists, which are essentially your target customers, but maybe they've never heard of you. When you look at, again, a confluence of all of that data, then you can start to figure out, oh, our current customers are actually willing to pay the lowest because we never, ever did any research on pricing and we were too skittish to make a high price, which is oftentimes what ends up happening. So yeah, it's just something to kind of consider and look at into is you do have to talk to your customers about this stuff and start off doing just regular phone calls or coffee meetings or probably phone calls right now or Zoom calls. And then, you know, over time, build up some surveys to do a little bit more of a higher volume research.
Got it. Guys, if you don't have any other questions, my question is going to be the last one. So drop your questions if you do have any. But here's a question from Kevin for self. And I know like we keep beating the dead horse probably, but no, for good. Self-serve SaaS, should we either go low ticket, like $25 a month, or high ticket, like $300 a month, and not be in the middle, like $60 to $150 a month?
It's a tough question. I think that I would say it depends on what stage you're in. I would say it's always easier to start high and lower your price or introduce lower tier offerings than it is to start low and go up. The difference between 25 and 300 is obviously a lot in a lot of ways. So I think that the better thing to do is just kind of think about what your strategy is and what your stage is. And if you can have multiple price points or you can only have like the one. The one thing to kind of keep in mind with like lower touch self-serve is that you get entranced by what's called the Amex effect, which basically is like, are they willing to just swipe the credit card? $300, that gets a little high for just swiping the credit card. But the stages of the Amex effect, there's a bunch of them between $0 and $50 a month. Between $50 and $75, it's like you should be $50 or $75 or thereabouts, and then you should be $75 or $100 or thereabouts. And then over that particular, it's either $100, $150, or $200. Like you rarely should have prices in between $100 and $150 and $150 and $200. It should just be one of those three. And then when you get over $200, it gets a little murky. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of direction on a couple of axes. But yeah.
That was very helpful.
Cool.
Awesome. Anything else? I don't think we have anything else. We have a bunch of thank you. So Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's been a little bit rough in the beginning. I'm glad that we finally made it.
No worries at all. And I'm going to do one more shameless plug. Follow me on Twitter. I'm Paticus, Patrick Campbell. This is where I publish most of my like cutting edge kind of data and research that I'm doing. So just throw that in there. And then normally that's what ends up getting published on the blog. So if you want the latest stuff, just head over there. But appreciate it, everyone. If you have any other questions, you got my email address as well. And yeah, have a good rest of the day.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see ya.